This time, brethren, we have a special blessing in store, I believe, to view a production that Brother Ken has been working on for some time to give hope to the nation of Israel, to give hope to the community of the Jews. I don't know that I can explain very much about it. It's going to be the first time probably most of us have seen it, so we will not even attempt to. We'll just turn the meeting over to Brother Ken.
Thank you, Brad. Originally, this slot on the program was to be a slide presentation of a trip that Sister Virginia and Vern and Zig Roguskin myself took to Israel last year, and a report on that trip. But last week, the convention committee asked me to show our AV for the Jewish people, Israel Appointment with Destiny. And I was rather reluctant to go ahead with it because I know nothing about the technical end of it. And Obi's my right-hand man, and he's not here. We couldn't bring out our professional equipment because we drove out in the compact car. So Obi dumped the stereo music and the narration from a four-track reel tape to a one-track or two-track cassette tape, and the Detroit Brethren have provided the home video stereo that we're pushing it through, so we'll see how it comes out. Also, to a Jewish audience, I won't put the production on unless they can promise me a pitch-black auditorium, which brings out the brilliancy of the pictures, which you won't have this afternoon. I'm sorry about that. Okay, just a word about the production and the purpose of the production. A word about witnessing to Jews. Certainly Jews will be called of the Lord into the high calling. And I believe, one, that all Jews who come into the high calling by the Lord's grace, it will be through hearing the message from the general witness work that's going on throughout the country continually. But secondly, in addition, I feel the scriptures single out the Jewish people are to have, at this end of the age, a special message of comfort. And I don't feel that these two efforts should be meshed together, but they should be separate and distinct. And both are important. Now, a word about the message of the production. The message is based on Isaiah 40 and 1. Comfort ye, my people. It's the type of message that Brother Russell gave at his famous Hippodrome mass meeting to the Jewish people. Something happened at that mass meeting that the brother and I are too familiar with, although it's recorded in the reprints. Just prior to the mass meeting, Brother Russell had printed a new booklet entitled Jewish Hopes and Prospects. It was composed of two things. One, a discourse, public discourse he had on Jerusalem, which was a discourse for Gentiles and Christians, and not specifically for Jews. And two, it incorporated in that booklet the third volume chapter, The Restoration of Natural Israel. After Brother Russell gave the Hippodrome speech, and remember, he was invited by the Jewish leaders, some very zealous Bible students started passing out this booklet to the Jews as they were leaving the Hippodrome. And right away, the Jewish leaders condemned Brother Russell for betraying their confidence. Before this talk, he had promised that he would in no way try to proselyte the Jewish people. And Brother Russell was so upset with the brethren using this booklet, because he said this booklet was not for the Jewish people, but it was for Christians. He made a public apology to the Jewish people through a number of Jewish presses, papers. But this just shows how that in the message of comfort, he tried to avoid conveying a missionary spirit of conversion, but rather to point them to the fulfillment of prophecies concerning Israel at the end of the age, preparing and developing their faith for the time when we know there will be the mass conversion of the Jewish people to Christ after the invasion of Gog and Magog. Now, after that Hippodrome message, Brother Russell had other mass meetings in this country. He went to abroad to all the major Jewish centers in Europe and held Jewish mass meetings. And between 1910 and 1914, several million pieces of literature, The Jewish Hope, was published in Yiddish and distributed throughout the world. And according to the Israeli Ministry of Religion, Pastor Russell enjoyed to his dying day the highest friendship with the later leaders of American Jewry. Now, this presentation, we're following this type of message of comfort. This approach might turn you on, it might turn you off, but I just want you to know ahead of time what the message is. Now, the format of the showing, approximately 45 minutes, will be recorded narration. Then there will be a live presentation, and the purpose of the live presentation is to take advantage of any current events, new developments concerning the Jewish people or Israel that will make the presentation that much more meaningful to the Jewish people. Then this approximately 10-minute live presentation will be followed by a 7-minute closing in the recorded narration. Okay, you know, some people have the ability to make a long story short. I have the ability to make a short story long. Just one further word and somewhat of a personal testimony, continuing our personal testimony on the panel discussion about what the Lord's presence means to us. I feel that this message for those who see the value of it and the need of it is a message that is to be given at this time. I embarked on this production with my family several years ago. We had made a contact with David Horowitz, who many of you know of. He opened some wonderful doors to Jewish leaders. But as sometimes happens with me, after I get all enthusiastic about something, then I begin to have misgivings. Well, how do I know this is really the Lord's will? Maybe these are just contacts that David Horowitz made. Another thing developed. So I thought, well, I'll just lay it aside for a while and just look for the Lord's leadings. And through prayer, you know, I consider myself, when I compare myself with my fellow elders and fellow speakers, somewhat uneducated and poor in English. But I began to write some articles and submit them to Jewish papers. They were published. Doors were opened to some very prominent personalities in the leadership of the Jewish people. And I feel that this was only through the Lord's providence. I've had some thrilling experiences of giving a personal witness to very prominent leaders of Jewry in this country and in Israel. I spent 15 minutes with Morris Abrams, who, on the pyramid of the Jewish Organization of American Jewry, he was on the top. He was the chairman of the President's Committee of all major Jewish organizations in the United States. Whenever the Jewish leaders would visit Israel or have a session with the President or go to the Pope and try to convince him to recognize Israel, Morris Abrams always led the delegation. And for 15 minutes, I was able to tell him God's plan for Israel. And I said, you know why the Pope refuses to recognize Israel's right to the city of Jerusalem? Do you know the theological reason? Because I know the political reason. Please tell me the theological reason. And I told him, and he was overwhelmed, and he thanked me for it. In Israel, I had sessions with I feel some of the most prominent rabbis in Israel, and was able to give a message of comfort to them, to tell them about Pastor Russell's message of comfort and what we're doing now. Rabbi Grossman, who I think is doing one of the most marvelous works in Israel, came up to me and put his arms around me. He said, "That's wonderful." He says, "You can do this better, and your people can do this better than a rabbi or a Jew can do it." So I took this as an indication from the Lord to go ahead with our production, and we completed it. About a month ago, we had our first showing to a Jewish audience, a B'nai B'rith group. They invited us. We didn't even make an initial approach to them. They just heard about our work. They invited their people. We didn't spend a penny on advertising. They had 250 people. And we had a standing ovation at the end of the presentation. So we thank the Lord for his leading in this matter. And we trust that this will be a blessing to you. Okay, now, pretend you're a Jewish audience, and we're about to start the presentation. I stand before you as a Christian minister. I know in most of your minds that's translating into, "So he's a goyim." A goyim isn't a very good term that Jews have for Gentiles. I stand before you as a lifelong friend and admirer of the Jewish people, a people whose history simply cannot be explained in anything other than supernatural terms. Often during the Christian era, the Jewish people were subjected to forced assimilation. Interestingly enough, this period is referred to by historians as the Dark Ages. Some commentary on the Christian churches, isn't it? Christian era, Dark Ages. But what grieves me even more than that forced assimilation is today the voluntary assimilation that is taking place in the Jewish community in America and worldwide. The Jewish community is self-destructing. So that you hear Jewish leaders use phrases like, "We're more interested in quality than quantity." It is because we as Bible students are interested in both the quality and the quantity of the Jewish community that we present Israel, Appointment with Destiny. Lights, please.
Day has witnessed many wonders, but perhaps the greatest comes from antiquity. After 2,000 years, the miraculous rebirth of a nation. The Bible Students, a Christian association, watch with excitement and hope. Hope entwined with the nation of Israel.
Shalom, I'm Jack Campbell. If you visited Israel sometime during the 1970s, you may have seen my sons and me at work on Masada, rebuilding ancient walls or repairing mosaic floors, for it was my privilege to be engaged as restorer there. During the Yom Kippur War and for the period of hostilities that followed, I served there as acting director. As a Bible student, I'm a Zionist. I believe Israel is the most dynamic, positive development in the world today. The historic position of Bible students as non-proselytizing friends of Jewry is well documented. Here's part of our record. Charles Taze Russell, the pastor of Bible student congregations around the world, proposed to Baron Rothschild a practical plan for Zionism. Several years later, Theodore Herzl made similar proposals that in 1897 resulted in the first Zionist Congress. Invited to write 12 articles in the noted Overland Monthly on God's chosen people, Pastor Russell chided Christendom for the absurdity of the doctrine of the Trinity, three gods in one, and commended the Jews for their monotheism based on the Shema Israel. Also, he urged Jews not to assimilate or convert to Christian churches. Jewish leaders invited Pastor Russell to address a Jewish mass meeting in New York's largest auditorium on the subject of Zionism in prophecy. Pastor Russell's Hippodrome address was enthusiastically received by an overflow crowd of 5,000 Jews. Until his death in 1916, Pastor Russell, by lectures and publications in Yiddish and English, continued to inspire Jews in the United States and Europe with Zionist hopes. Bible students tell the Jewish people that the Gentile times have expired. Therefore, the Jews should go up and take their land. According to their faith, it will be unto them. During the Hitler persecutions, Professor Franklin Hudgings, a Bible student, by publications and lectures, enthused Jewish audiences with Zionist hopes based on their prophets. Bible students continued in their tradition of encouraging the Jewish people, and these efforts were appreciated. As an incitement to courage and faith, Emunah, Bible students fraternally present Israel, Appointment with Destiny.
None else. There is no God beside me. I form the light and create darkness. I, even my hands, have stretched out the heavens. I have made the earth and created man upon it. When I divided to the nations their inheritance, when I separated the sons of Adam, I set the bounds of the nations according to the number of the children of Israel. For Israel is my portion. Israel is my inheritance. I am the God of Israel. I have formed thee, O Israel. Thou shalt not be forgotten of me. I, the Lord, shall preserve thy going out and thy coming in from this time forth and even forevermore.
Over 4,000 years ago, Israel's destiny was fixed when God appeared to Father Abraham, saying, "Get thee out of thy country, and from thy kindred, and from thy father's house, unto the land that I will show thee. And I will make of thee a great nation, and I will bless thee, and make thy name great. In thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed." This promise was to be so important that God did something he never did again. He confirmed it by an oath when Abraham offered up his son. "In blessing, I will bless thee, and thy seed shall possess the gate of his enemies. and in thy seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed. Notice the promise has two parts. First, the seed of Abraham is to possess the land forever. And secondly, Israel, as part of Abraham's seed, is to bless all other nations. What a destiny, fixed by divine will. Israel is to possess the land of Canaan forever, and ultimately will be a blesser nation to all other nations in Messiah's kingdom. 400 years after God's promise was made, Moses delivered Abraham's descendants from Egyptian slavery. Then, at Mount Sinai, God gave his Torah to his people Israel. Under Joshua, Israel secured some of the promised land. Their national glory reached its zenith during the reigns of David and Solomon. But the great deflection from divine law during Solomon's reign caused the Lord to divide the nation. For 400 years, Judah waned until the destruction of Jerusalem. Although the Babylonian captivity came to an end, Judah remained a vassal state. Yet there were spurts of glory. Although the first temple was destroyed, there was the joy of the second. Esther saved her people, and Purim was born. Judas Maccabeus defied military logic, and Israel was free for about 100 years. Again provoked by cruel exploitation and armed with little more than a fierce independence, Israel found itself in open revolt against Rome, the iron-fisted masters of the world. Jerusalem was taken, the second temple destroyed. Notwithstanding the heroics of Masada and the Bar Kokhba revolt, the great dispersion to the ends of the earth began. Then, under the terrors of Christendom, the Jewish people left a footprint of blood in every nation. As Christians, Bible students are appalled at these centuries of bloodletting. This was not true Christianity, but the inevitable corruptions of a church-state system. Christendom was looking for a scapegoat to cover its own ills. Many rabbis use Hosea 3, verses 4 and 5 to explain Israel's adversity since the destruction of the temple. For the children of Israel shall sit solitary many days without king, and without prince, and without sacrifice, and without pillar, and without ephod or teraphim. Afterward shall the children of Israel return and seek the Lord their God and David their king, and shall come trembling unto the Lord and to his goodness in the end of days. Bible students have keenly felt the commission of Isaiah 40, verses 1 and 2. Comfort ye my people, saith your God. Bid Jerusalem take heart, and proclaim unto her that she has received of the Lord's hand double for all her sins. Israel was to be especially encouraged and comforted when her double ended. What is this double or duplicate portion? Israel's history covers two periods of time, each 1,845 years. Israel was to experience a double or duplicate period of disfavor equal to her period of favor. The time prophecies of the double showed Israel's period of national disfavor ended in 1878. In that very year, the Berlin Congress of Nations was held. Benjamin Disraeli, the first and only Jewish Prime Minister of England, was there. By Disraeli's maneuvering, England was given a protectorate over Turkey's Middle East provinces, including Palestine. Centuries-old restrictions on Jews to buy land and settle were eased. The time to favor Zion had indeed come, for Israel has an appointment with destiny. Even before 1878, Bible students predicted this date would mark the beginning of national favor returning to Israel. David Ben-Gurion's speech on Israel's 10th anniversary confirmed the Bible students' predictions.
The state did not come into existence on that great day of May 14, 1948. Nor was it the 650,000 Jews who lived in the country on that great day who established it. Pioneering activities of three generations preceded the Declaration of Independence, beginning in 1878, when the first Hebrew settlement in the country, Petah Tikva, was founded.
Petah Tikva, the first Jewish colony for Aliyah, means door of hope. For years thereafter, many new Olim, like the young Ben-Gurion, were trained in Petah Tikva. Sitting on the hillside together at night, they would sing Hatikva and dream of reestablishing the Jewish state. ...1878 marked God's favor for Aliyah. 1914 marked the beginning of the end of Gentile dominion over Eretz Israel. In Leviticus 26, Moses warned Israel that if they disobeyed God's commandments, they would experience temporary captivity. If their waywardness persisted, they would be a vassal state, and finally be dispersed among the Gentiles for sevenfold, or seven times, while the land of Israel was desolated by Gentile dominion. A prophetic time is equal to one lunar year of 360 days. The Hebrew prophets teach us that each day of a prophetic year is representative of an actual historical year. Therefore, the seven times of Leviticus 26 are symbolic of a 2,520-year time period. Babylon took Judah captive in the year 606 BCE, and although many Jews returned 70 years later, Israel was essentially a vassal state until the Roman dispersion. Adding 2,520 years to the year 606 BCE brings us to the prophetically indicated year 1914. Since the 16th century, the land of Israel had been part of the Turkish Empire. When Turkey joined forces with Germany in World War I, the hearts of world Jewry beat faster. If Turkey was defeated, the Jews could lay claim to their land. For the first time in centuries, light could be seen at the end of the tunnel. 7 days after Britain declared war against Turkey, Herbert Samuel, the only Jew in the British cabinet, made a fervent appeal for a Jewish state. Samuel's work from 1914 onward laid the foundations for Chaim Weizmann obtaining the Balfour Declaration. Finally, in 1917, the Balfour Declaration was issued. The declaration read, "His Majesty's government views with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine, or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country." Indeed, 1914 was the beginning of the end of Gentile dominion over Israel, in fulfillment of Leviticus 26. Therefore, World War I resulted in the Allied promise of a Jewish state. Also in 1914, Vladimir Gabotinsky and Joseph Trumpeldor began their work of organizing a Jewish army to fight with the British and throw off the yoke of Gentile dominion over Eretz Israel. Inspired by the hope of a Jewish state, many of the Jewish Legion gave their lives to take their land from the hands of the Turks. For many years, Bible students predicted that 1914 would mark the end of the 2,520 years of Gentile dominion. After 1914, Bible students encouraged their Jewish friends to go up and take possession of the land. For they had an appointment with destiny. In Ezekiel 37, a dramatic prophecy of Israel's restoration is given. Ezekiel is shown a valley filled with dry bones. These bones are identified in verse 11 as Israel's hopeless condition as a nation. Although alive as a people, national poverty had been dead for centuries. But in 1878, the bones began to come together. In 1914, sinew began to cover the bones, then flesh and skin. In 1948, the miracle occurred, and the body of national polity emerged. Israel was a nation again. Why? Remember that the promise to Abraham contained two parts. First, Israel was to possess the land forever. And second, Israel was to be a blessing to all other nations. In 1948, Israel met its first appointment with divine destiny. The state of Israel will never be destroyed. It is now marching toward its second appointment with divine destiny, the blessing of all nations under Messiah's kingdom. The new Israeli state is a miracle of history. Never before has a nation been destroyed, its people dispersed to the ends of the earth, and then, nearly 2,000 years later, regathered to their homeland and reestablished as a nation. On May 14, 1948, Israel declared itself an independent state. Another miracle occurred. The armies of seven Arab nations marched on the newborn state, boasting that they would push the Jews into the sea. Outnumbered 100-1, Israel not only repelled the invaders, but acquired more of Palestine than was granted in the United Nations partition plan. During this war, Jordan had seized the biblical Jerusalem. Therefore, Israel declared the new city of Jerusalem as its capital. But deep in their hearts, they knew that the real Jerusalem was occupied by Jordan. Nevertheless, it was apparent that God was dealing once again with Israel as a nation. Many predictions of the Hebrew prophets relating to Israel's regathering since 1878 are being fulfilled. And the Lord said, "Behold, I will bring them from the north country, and gather them from the coasts of the earth, and with them the blind and the lame, the woman with child, and her that travaileth with child together. A great company shall return thither." The law of return declared that any Jew, anywhere, could return. In fulfillment of Jeremiah 31:8, all, both maimed and whole, were welcome to the shores of Israel. There have been some very unique aliyot. The most colorful was Operation Magic Carpet. The Yemenite Jews lived in a very ancient culture. Many had never seen an airplane, and concern arose that they might not enter one. They arrived at the airport, and when told to board the planes, rushed forward without hesitation. Why? They recalled the scripture that they were to return to the promised land on the wings of an eagle. Jews from India, the Falasha of Ethiopia, and others from the four corners of the earth have been regathered. Jeremiah 16:16 foretold the conditions that would result in Aliyah. Verses 14 and 15 speak of the regathering from all nations. Then verse 16 says, "Behold, I will send for many fishers, saith the Lord, and they shall fish them. And after will I send for many hunters, and they shall hunt them from every mountain and from every hill and out of the holes of the rocks." The fishers were the Zionist movement. As a fisherman uses bait, so the Zionist movement used the idealism of a national homeland to inspire Jews to return to the land of their fathers. God raised Theodor Herzl, who founded the modern Zionist movement in 1897. In his book, Herzl portrayed the idealism of a Jewish state.
The promised land, where we can have hooked noses, black or red beards, and bow legs, without being despised for it, where we can live at last as free men on our own soil, and where we can die peacefully in our own fatherland. There we can expect the rewards of honor for great deeds, so that the offensive cry of Jew may become an honorable appellation, like German, Englishman, Frenchman, in brief, like all civilized people, so that we may be able to form our own state, to educate our people for the task which at present still lie before our own vision. For surely, God would not have kept us alive so long if there were not assigned to us a specific role in the history of mankind.
Hunters, as well as fishers, are mentioned in Jeremiah 16:16. Divine foreknowledge knew the anti-Semitism of the Gentile heart. Persecutors like the Nazis literally drove the Jews out of the nations. Yad Vashem was erected that the new generations of Jews would never forget the Holocaust and never permit it to happen again. In the memorial chapel, an eternal flame burns as a symbol that the Jewish race will never be extinguished. The floor is composed of 6 million tiles, one for each Jew slaughtered. The name of each death camp is also memorialized here. All the school children in Israel are bused to Yad Vashem to learn a bitter fact of history, that in times of crisis, the Jew is often turned upon as a scapegoat and becomes the victim of pent-up hate and scorn. How cruel, yet how true. The Holocaust is an indictment of so-called Christian Europe. Both Catholic and Protestant sociologists observed that the Nazi extermination of 6 million Jews was impossible without the active cooperation of the public. The suppressed Gentile anti-Semitism surfaced in that atmosphere of self-preservation, and thousands of professed Christians turned informant or cooperated in numerous other ways. By 1942, the Allied powers, the so-called Christian West, were aware of the genocide, but refused to bomb the railroads leading to the death camps. Christendom was revealed for what it had become, a hollow shell of professions. Yet in that dark night of hate, there were a few lights of love, memorialized in the Garden of the Righteous of the Gentiles at Yad Vashem. Each tree honors specific Gentile individuals or families that risked life itself to save the Jews from the Holocaust. Yes, the hunters came, but the enormity of the horror indicates more. Satan knew the Jewish state would play an important role in Messiah's kingdom. The regathering of the Jews was an essential step toward that destiny. Satan devised this diabolical plot to exterminate the descendants of Abraham and thus thwart the kingdom. Only satanic influence could inspire scenes like this. thank the Lord, Satan's plot failed. The Gentile world, after reneging on their promise since 1917, and now guilt-ridden, finally felt a moral obligation to grant the Jews an independent state. Jeremiah prophesied that returning Jews would first have to buy the land. Between 1878 and 1948, millions of dollars were raised through worldwide fund drives to purchase land for settlement. Over 90% of the land purchased was barren waste, for which exorbitant prices were paid to a small class of wealthy Muslim landowners. In 1905, Dr. Abraham Kuyper, Prime Minister of the Netherlands, wrote of his trip to Palestine. Quote, "The Jews have come in vain. Only God can check the blight of the inrushing desert. Only a miracle can save the Holy Land." Unquote. The reclamation of the land to the fertility of old is a miraculous fulfillment of the Hebrew prophets. "And they shall build the waste cities and inhabit them, and they shall plant vineyards and drink the wine thereof. They shall also make gardens and eat the fruit of them." Israel is a land of cities built upon the desert. In 1910, upon barren sand, the city of Tel Aviv was founded. Its mayor was elected before ground was broken. It is now one of the largest and most beautiful cities in Israel. Well did the prophet say, "They shall build the waste cities and inhabit them." In addition to barren desert, vast malaria-infested swamps defied all reclamation efforts by wealthy Arab landowners. The Jews then bought the land and fought and finally won the battle of reclaiming the malarial swamps, but at great price. Henrietta Sold, founder of Hadassah, wrote in 1920,
"It is not I who am ill, but nearly everybody around me. Malaria is a terrible plague. All the stones of this country, and heaven knows there are plenty of them, appear to cry out in pain. The immigrants, who are arriving at the rate of 300 a week, contract it in the first 8 days. They go into the country to work and soon return, asking to be admitted to hospitals that don't exist. Every day we are turning away sick people with temperatures of 102. Even if we had all the gold in the world, we could not prevent these first immigrants from becoming fertilizer for the land. Our task requires the sacrifice of young lives. It is a struggle with nature. I still believe it is worth the while, but it is hard, very hard."
The Hula Valley, one of the worst swamps to be conquered, became one of the most fertile parts of all the land. Fish ponds are nestled within beautiful farmland throughout the valley. Exporting fish has become a major industry. Citrus fruits, wheat, avocados, and vegetables of every kind are grown on ground made fertile by the sacrifices of many Jewish lives. Where there is water, there is life. After the capture of Mount Hermon and the Golan Heights in the 67 War, Israel found itself in the skiing business. Beginning with the snows of Mount Hermon, Israel has one of the most extensive irrigation systems of any nation. From melting snow and rains, water collects in the foothills. Through various tributaries, the waters of Mount Hermon funnel into the Jordan River. Thank you. Once the Jordan has descended an elevation of over 900 feet, the muddied river flows into the sweet, crystal-clear waters of the Sea of Galilee, also called the Sea of Gennesaret. After traveling 12 miles through the purifying sea, the Jordan exits the fresh, living water for a dead and thirsty land. Is it any wonder the rabbis say, Adonai has created seven seas, but the Sea of Gennesaret is his delight. Upon leaving the Galilee, the Jordan pursues a winding course all along which its waters are diverted through pumping stations, pipes, aqueducts, and ditches to bring life to the parched land. After a journey of over 200 miles, some of the water from the snows of Mount Hermon flows into this reservoir to create fertile farmland for a kibbutz near Beersheba. Where there is water, there is life. Israel in Bible times enjoyed two seasons of copious rain, the early and latter rains. During the double of disfavor, the latter rains ceased to fall, and the early rains fell only moderately. The Hebrew prophets foretold that during Israel's regathering, the latter rains, which had not fallen for centuries, would fall again. The early rains would increase. This has been remarkably fulfilled. Since the turn of the century, and especially since the birth of the new Israeli state, there has been a phenomenal increase in rainfall. In fulfillment of Bible prophecy, the land from north to south is returning to its ancient fertility, producing three and four crops yearly. Today, exports of Israeli produce to Europe exceed European production. The greatest miscalculation President Nasser of Egypt ever made was his demand that the United Nations remove its peacekeeping force in the Sinai. This inevitably touched off the 67 war. Although outnumbered, the Israeli army overran the combined forces of Egypt, Syria, and Jordan in six short days. Fulfillment of Bible prophecy, the Sinai, the Golan Heights, the West Bank, and Old Jerusalem became Israeli territory, one of the greatest military feats in history. Old city of Jerusalem was taken in fulfillment of Zechariah's prophecy. Behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of trembling unto all the people round about, when they shall be in the siege both against Judah and Jerusalem. And in that day I will make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all people. All that burden themselves with it shall be cut in pieces, though all the people of the earth be gathered together against it. Jerusalem is a problem to two groups. Verse 2 identifies the people round about Israel, Arab nations. Verse 3 states that the city is also a burdensome stone to all the people of the earth. Verse 6 reveals that as a result of war with the Arabs, the people round about, Jerusalem shall inhabit its own place, even in Jerusalem, a unique race. What does it mean? In 1948, when Jordan took the old city, Israel declared the new city of Jerusalem as its capital. But in their hearts, the Israelis knew the Bible Jerusalem was in the hands of the Arabs. When Jordan entered the 67 war, the Israelis attacked Old Jerusalem with a religious fervor. With the capture of the Old City, Jerusalem, Israel's capital, now occupied its own place, even in the biblical city of Jerusalem, a remarkable fulfillment of Zechariah's prophecy. Not only were Jews denied access to their holy places during Jordanian occupation, the holy places were deliberately desecrated. Sacred stones were used for walkways. Since the 67 victory, a Muslim holy place has never been desecrated by Israel. Both Arabs and Christians have access to their holy places. Between 1948 and 1967, Jordan had systematically destroyed the old city's Jewish quarter, leveling synagogues, and eliminating evidence of Jerusalem's Jewish character. Since 1967, the Israeli government embarked on an ambitious building program. The old synagogues have been rebuilt. The largest, Hirva, was left in ruins, this arch being built as a memorial to another of the endless list of indignities suffered in the Jewish quarter. Now, with the old city once again in Israeli hands, such indignities have been brought to an end. The restored Jewish quarter is sufficient testimony that Jerusalem could never be surrendered after the remarkable recapture of Israel's true capital in the 67 war. Jerusalem means city of peace, yet few cities have experienced more wars than Jerusalem in its 4,000 years. Still a center of controversy, the Bible reveals that Jerusalem will soon become the city of eternal peace, the capital of Messiah's kingdom, which will bring peace and righteousness to the whole earth. One senses the presence of those prophets who, centuries before, walked the streets of Jerusalem. History surrounds you. David's shaft, through which his army entered Jerusalem unawares and captured it. King Hezekiah's tunnel, constructed over 27 centuries ago. Archaeological digs yield thrilling finds. The stairs and paved streets that led to the Second Temple. The divine name on a silver amulet dating back to the days of the First Temple. Babylonian arrowheads next to the remains of an Israeli defense tower. The first evidence of the siege and destruction of First Temple Jerusalem. Further excitement is felt at the discovery of the actual foundation stones of both the First and Second Temples.
Jerusalem,
Who can doubt Jewish antiquity in Jerusalem? Who can doubt Israel's right to Jerusalem? Further, this is the holy city of the Jews, as is pointedly reflected at the Western Wall, part of the Temple Mount. For centuries, this was the center of Jewish worship, especially during the periods of Solomon's and Herod's temples. Is it any wonder that the Jews throng here to pray, the same place their ancestors had worshipped for nearly 3,000 years? But how holy is Jerusalem to the Arabs? When Arabs worship in the Mosque of Omar, they face this niche, for this niche faces Mecca in Saudi Arabia. The Arabs in Jerusalem face towards Saudi Arabia to pray. The Arabian center of worship is Mecca, not Jerusalem. To the Jews, Jerusalem always was and ever will be the center of their worship. Western powers, including the United States, insist that Jerusalem is negotiable in any Israeli-Arab peace talks. Jerusalem is not negotiable. Archaeology and history confirm Jerusalem is in the hands of its rightful owners. Remember Zechariah's prophecy. All nations who involve themselves in the Jerusalem issue will be sorely wounded. The nations of the world had better heed this warning. The Israelis are determined that their state will never be destroyed again. Masada was symbolic of the destruction of the Second Commonwealth. Its defenders are glorious heroes of Jewish history. At night, in awe-inspiring ceremonies on the slopes of Masada, new Israeli Defense Force recruits take the solemn oath, Masada shall not fall again. They have kept their oath. The IDF has fought five brilliant wars and emerged from the Lebanese War rated the fourth strongest military force in the world. But the Jewish people are weary of war. Israel wants peace. Camp David proved that Israel is willing to sacrifice much for peace. They gave Egypt the whole Sinai. This made their southern border very militarily vulnerable. But they were willing to take this chance for peace. They gave Egypt the Sinai oil wells, which had supplied 75% of their energy needs. This played havoc on their economy, but it was a price they were willing to pay for peace. And still the world asks Israel to give more. Israel asks, what have the Arabs given for peace? Israel wants peace with its Arab neighbors so that they can concentrate on their economic crisis. Despite the existence of so-called moderate Arabs, many still feel that the Arabs are intent on the destruction of the Jewish state. Arab military sophistication is on the increase. Seemingly, time is on their side. It is only a matter of time before an Arab country has nuclear weapons. Also, Israel's economic crisis is of major concern. Without massive annual grants from the United States and the Herculean donations from world Jewry, Israel would very likely collapse. Further, world opinion is turning against Israel. This accentuates her military and economic problems. Can Israel survive the overwhelming long-term problems facing her? Kenneth Rawson, a Bible student, and for over 30 years, a student of the Middle East.
Security of Israel. But how can Israel be secure in view of the demographic problem? In just 15 years, the area containing Gaza, the West Bank, and the State of Israel will contain a majority of Arabs. I don't care what the peace solution might be. And by the way, even the left-of-center element in Israel are thinking no longer in terms of an immediate peace solution, but a peace solution and process that will take 10 to 15 years. But whatever the peace solution, whether it is the annexation of the West Bank by Israel or a federated Palestinian state with the Jordan nation, or even an outright Palestinian independent state, whatever the negotiated peace, a majority of Arabs in 15 years in a territory smaller than the state of New Jersey spells trouble for Israel. The Arabs have a proverb. Taste is of the devil. One of the most exciting items of news concerning the Jews recently, just in the past 2 weeks, can provide the solution to Israel's demographic problem. We know already there are many Russian Jews coming to the United States. This year, in 1989, they expect 50,000. A secret Israeli government report on Russian Jewry asserts that the overwhelming majority of Russian Jews wish to immigrate from Russia, and that hundreds of thousands can expect it to do so in the next several years. But the important thing, according to this secret Israeli report, is that the Russian government will let them leave. All of them that want to leave. In the beginning, in increments of 50,000 a year. You and the Jewish community know the tug of war between the American Jewish community and Israel for the Russian Jews. All right. This year there will be 50,000 Russian Jews immigrating to the United States. But the American Jewish community and Israel face a tremendous challenge to get the proper perspective of things and aliyah the Russian Jews to Israel. And this itself will be a fulfillment of prophecy, which predicts a great regathering from the north. There is one thing that is certain to ensure peace and stability in the Middle East, and that is the aliyah of over 1 million Jews to Israel in the next 10 years. Then the Arab nations will be anxious to come to peace terms with the State of Israel. And however peace comes, Isaiah 11 shows that there will be peace between Israel and her Arab neighbors. And then sometime in the future, the prophet Ezekiel speaks of Israel dwelling in peace with her neighbors and dwelling in prosperity, not dependent upon outside economic support. What is this prosperity she will enjoy? Ezekiel chapters 38 and 39 speak of a spoil that will be the envy of the nations, a great economic wealth that Israel will yet acquire sometime in the near future. Look up when you get home. Ezekiel 38 and 39 in your Bible. And look at the commentaries of your rabbis. What is this great economic wealth? Well, possibly Israel might yet strike it rich in oil. Don't laugh. Last summer, when I was in the Prime Minister's office in Jerusalem, there was great excitement about a contract that was just signed 2 weeks before with Arm & Hammer of Occidental Petroleum. Occidental Petroleum feels that there is a large, major vein of oil in the Mediterranean, 10 miles off shore from Tel Aviv. Or possibly, this great economic wealth will come from the mineral wealth of the Dead Sea. It's well known that every mineral there is in the Dead Sea. Platinum, gold, silver, every type of mineral and chemical element. Well, that's there. This is such a tremendous wealth, 3 times the wealth of the United States. Why don't they take it out? There is no economic feasible way of extracting it in mass amounts. Why? Because electrolysis is the most effective process of extracting this mineral wealth. And electrolysis requires great sources of energy, and Israel does not have energy. But there is still talk. It's been revived again. Of a channel from the Mediterranean to the Dead Sea to solve the ecological problem by the Dead Sea drying up so much. And this great surge of water down from the Mediterranean Sea to the Dead Sea would create a tremendous amount of cheap electricity that could provide the cheap energy necessary to extract the wealth from the Dead Sea. Yes, Israel yet will become prosperous. Remember, Chaim Weizmann said, Israel is a place where miracles happen. And then Ezekiel 38 and 39 shows that in this prosperity, the Gentile nations will, through trouble and war, become more depleted and look to Israel, and there will be a vast invasion of the armies of the north of that state of Israel. And the prophet Ezekiel reveals the dramatic deliverance of Israel in this invasion. Light, please.
Lord, I will call for a sword against God throughout all my mountains. I will plead against him with pestilence and with blood. And I will cause rain to rain upon him and his bands, and upon the many people with him, an overflowing shower and great hailstones. I will make myself known in the eyes of many nations, and they shall know that I am God. So the house of Israel shall know that I am the Lord God. Neither will I hide my face any more from them. For I will pour out my spirit upon the house of Israel.
Israel will stand alone before this massive invading force. Even the United States will forsake her. The Hebrew of Zechariah 12:8 teaches that the Lord will protect and deliver those who bend the knee, that is, implore the Lord in prayer for help. How are they helped? By the angel of the Lord that goeth before them. Not by Israel's military might, not by her alliances, but by divine intervention will this massive invasion be defeated. Then Israel's appointment with destiny will be fulfilled. The law will go forth from Zion, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. Despite centuries of persecution, Jewish hearts have remained enlarged toward their fellow men. Judaism has a vision that has never dimmed or narrowed. The Hebrew prophets beautifully portray this vision as Messiah's kingdom. Now Israel, a disciplined, humbled, redeemed people, will fulfill their vision of worldwide peace, prosperity, and health to all. The kingdom will assure equity and justice for all. The psalmist says, "He will defend the cause of the poor, deliver the needy, and crush the oppressor." Our history is one of bloody war, but in Messiah's kingdom, they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Think of the parched drought belt of Africa, where millions have starved to death in recent years. The climatic conditions of the kingdom will cause the earth to bring forth in abundance. The blossoming of the Negev since the rebirth of Israel is the Lord's assurance that his promises are true. There will be no sickness, no crippling diseases, no cancer, diabetes, heart failure. The blind will see, the deaf hear, and the crippled walk. Messiah's kingdom will satisfy all the legitimate longings of humankind. The Torah presents you with a challenge. Your Jewish heritage comes before anything else. Don't ever forget this fact of life. Don't resent it or try to hide from it. Rather, cherish your Abrahamic heritage. Divine providence has an appointment with Israel. Your lifetime may see the Messianic kingdom ushered in, when the children of Abraham will bless all the nations of the earth. Yes, the Torah will go forth from Zion, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. Now that God's appointed time has come for Israel to become a nation, ponder deeply your responsibility to Israel. Are Israel's concerns your concerns? Are Zionism's needs your opportunity?
Remember these things, O Jacob and Israel. For thou art my servant, I have formed thee. Thou art mine own servant. O Israel, thou shalt not forget me. I have blotted out, as a thick cloud, thy transgressions, and, as a cloud, thy sins. Return unto me, for I have redeemed thee. In those days it shall come to pass, that 10 men shall take hold out of all the languages of the nations, shall even take hold of the skirt of him that is a Jew, saying, "We will go with you, for we have heard that God is with you." At that time they shall call Jerusalem the throne of the Lord, and all the nations shall be gathered unto it, to the name of the Lord, to Jerusalem. Neither shall they walk any more after the stubbornness of their evil heart. And Jerusalem shall be called the City of Truth and the Mountain of the Lord of Hosts, the Holy Mountain.
The Torah will go forth from Jerusalem. The Gentiles will come to thy light.
Well, that's it. You can't say everything in one message. And in your first message, you can't say everything that you would like to say, because you have to gain confidence. And we feel that if the Lord blesses this, that there will be other times to give a more advanced message to the Jewish people. I want to thank Greg again for all his labors, his unknown equipment, unfamiliar equipment with him. We obviously, at the closing part, lost some of the cues, but I think you got the gist of it. Thanks again, Greg. Okay, where's our chairman?
Thank you very much, Brother Kenneth. I must say there was a few moments there that I didn't think my hair was going to stay in my head. It seemed like it just wanted the exhilaration of the photographs and the words spoken. This truly will be able to, if the Lord so provides, be a message to the Jews that there is only one who has brought them back to their land. And it will also serve to let them be aware of how Christians, how we as Christians feel about their existence and their regathering. We'd like to ask Brother Ken to close this service with prayer, and we'd like to ask you to remain seated, and we'll have a few closing remarks before we depart. Brother Ken.
Loving Father, we humbly bow in your holy presence at the close of this day, close of this convention. So thankful for your presence and your blessing. And so thankful for the instruction from your word and the fellowship of kindred hearts. And now as we part one from another, be with each as we go our respective way, and bring us together again if it be your will. And for all mankind, we longingly pray that thy kingdom fully come and thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. In Jesus' name, amen.